Studies Director. Since this is opening night, I would like to share with you some of the history leading to this moment. The River Styx Poets began in 1970 when a group of then young writers, including myself, started a 2-hour radio program on listener-sponsored KDNA, the same station on which Leonard Slatkin had a classical program. We called ourselves the River Styx Poets because colloquial, convivial Dante's river that carried souls seemed to fit the mighty Mississippi with its flotilla of literary and political ghosts. We looked both to the past and to the future. The program featured live poetry, music, discussions, the works, and grew in popularity. More importantly, it established that an audience that extended well beyond the confines of the university existed for poetry. When KDNA was suddenly sold in 1973 and transformed into a new commercial station, the River Styx Poets sought a new medium, and River Styx Magazine came into being. It took 2 years to produce the first issue, but the positive response to it surprised even us. Issue one is now a collector's item. From the outset, we tried to root the magazine in the ground that nourishes it, the Midwest, by publishing as our nucleus local writers and graphic artists. Also, national and internationally known writers were featured from the beginning, along with distinctive artwork and magazine design. We have tried to strengthen our international and multicultural dimension over the years. Since its beginning, River Styx Magazine has featured many of the most celebrated and exciting writers in the world. St. Louis's own Howard Nemiroff, William Gass, Mona Van Doyne, Constance Erdang, Howard Schwartz, Michael Castro, John Nofel, Shirley LaFleur, Arthur Brown, and internationally respected author Nelson Wu, the Edward H. Mallinckrodt Distinguished Professor of Chinese Art and Culture. We also feature translations of internationally notable writers Jorge Luis Borges, Pablo Neruda, Octavio Paz, the award-winning translations of Cesar Vallejo by Clayton Eshelman, and internationally known American writers John Hollander, Allen Ginsberg, William Stafford, Ishmael Reed, Antozake Shange, St. Louis's Quincy Troupe, and Native American poets, including Simon Ortiz. From its beginning, River Styx has featured St. Louis-based artists, including Michael Kor, Alejandro L. Romero, Bill Cohn, Muriel Nesney, Sheldon Helfman, and photographers Michael Eastman, Bob Kohlbrenner, and Jerry Minahan, and sculptor Ernest Trova. The basic concerns, the local, the multicultural, and the visual have remained with River Styx. Poets bearing conflicting labels, old or young, traditional or avant-garde, famous or unknown, have all been brought into the community of expression, the communion of languages and images, which comprises River Styx. During this period of growth, Big River Association was founded as a not-for-profit organization. Big River was successful in rekindling the oral tradition by establishing the Duff's Poetry Series in 1975. The series features poets and musicians on the same program and sometimes performing together, as they have done throughout the ages. Duff's, as many here know, has been a success, drawing large and enthusiastic crowds. With the River Styx PM series, we hope to bring this activity into a new phase and to reach a broader audience. Big River's River Styx Magazine and public programs, in combination with the excellent writers in the area associated with the Washington University Writers Program and a younger generation of writers just coming into their own, have given St. Louis national recognition as a center of a rich, vital, and varied American poetics. Looking at our recent history, One can say that the growth of the literary arts has been the best thing to happen in St. Louis since Stan Musial retired. Or, looking to the immediate future, we intend to fill the vacuum that may occur if Templeton is traded. I want to thank the St. Louis Art Museum for housing the series, and to thank the person who championed the idea of the series since its inception, the honorary chairman of the board of Big River, Mrs. Marge May. Mrs. May has shared her insight, leadership, and energy in the planning and creation of our series. I want to thank the other distinguished board members, my co-workers, the businesses, the St. Louis Arts and Humanities Commission, and the St. Louis Poetry Center for their support. Since 80% of our funding comes from individual donations, we still do need your support. Not only are donations tax deductible, but also our angels will receive many gifts and benefits. And now, I would like to introduce the first guest artist on tonight's program. The eminent violinist Manuel Ramos is a sensitive and articulate craftsman with more than a touch of genius. He will perform the Partita in D minor by J.S. Bach. With great pleasure, we open the River Styx PM series with music that celebrates the highest aspirations of the human spirit.
Unless you, nobody ever remembers how it was, and everybody's always surprised again by how long the fall went on, how marvelous it was, but it's that way most every year. This is called Again, Again, and, you know, takes you through from the beginning the leaves turn to the first snow. It's got a couple of clever words. You don't even get in dictionaries. Mull and duff is that dreck that hits the forest floor and lies there for years. An intervale is, you know, where two mountain ranges come down to a piece of water. It's a between vale. Again, great season, sing it through again before we fall asleep. Sing the slow change that makes October burn out red and gold and color bleed into the world and die. And butterflies among the fluttering leaves disguise themselves until the few last leaves spin to the ground or to the skimming streams that carry them along until they sink. And through the muted land, the nevergreen needles and mull and duff of the forest floor, the wind go ashen. Till one afternoon the cold snow cloud comes down the intervale above the river, on whose slow black flood the few first flakes come hurrying in to drown. So I took to writing poems in single sentences. That's why you get a little breathless. And I told Kenneth Burke that justification for this, which was that the reader thinks he's swooning with emotion when really he's just getting a little blue in the face trying to track it down, find the verb somewhere. Well, while at it, I might as well try one even longer on that and hope to get the breaths in the right places. It's called A Christmas Storm, and the only poetic license I've ever taken in my life was that it happened on New Year's 2 years ago. But I decided for nefarious reasons of my own I would put it at Christmas. And it again is one sentence, but this time a page and a half long. See, we're not so simple-minded. the Christmas storm. All Sunday and Sunday night, cold water drops at the will of heaven, freezing where it hits, glazing the windshields and the glistening ways, sheathing the branches and the power lines in leaden insulations uniform across the counties and the towns, until connections loosen out and lines come down, and limbs that had sustained the horizontal 100 years unstrained crack under the weight of stiffened wet and short transformers out, so that 10,000 homes turned suddenly off go gray and silent, and the cold comes in slowly at first, then faster, drifting through the window frames ghostly, under doors, while night comes on, and provident families remember where the candles and lanterns were from last year, and other families don't, while lucky families light fires and others can't but bundle up in blankets or skid down street to the kindness of their neighbors or their kin, and cars caught out or paralyzed at hills, and it is clear that the relentless rain will go unrelentingly on till it relents, which it does do only next day at dawn, when sunrise summons up the pride of the eye to radiant brocades of Fabergé drainpipes and eaves and scintillant fans of bush and tree turned emblems of themselves, where every twig is one and three, itself, its chrysalis in ice transparent, and last haloed in splintering light, as in the great museum of mind, million Christmas trees illuminate their diamonded display to crystal and magnificent candelabra of silver, winking ruby and emerald and gold, as angled to the sun by the glittering wind, to show forth, to show up, to show off the rarely tinseled treasures of the world before the powerful, before the poor. And while the snow is coming, here's another one about that. I was wondering why there are so few poems about snow falling. There are many poems about snow being on the ground, but at least in English poetry, there's very little. I thought at first, well, the answer is they don't have much snow there. But then when they did have snow, why wouldn't the poets rush out and celebrate right away? I don't know. This is called The Unexpected Snow. It's 2 years ago. The networks knew nothing of it, or if they did, it was two states west of us and heading south. But as February's light began to fade, the flakes began to fall, speckles at first, but growing fast till they reminded us of moths clustered about the cold street light, a mortal permanence fluttering always at once, yet averaging out to gravity, so that by morning half a foot of it, allowing an inch or so each way for drift, had lifted the level of the winter ground unpromising and brown, and made it white with shadows blue under the blue spruce, and melting masses collapsing off the roof in small catastrophes that never harmed so much as a cat. And all this came about on a Friday night, leaving us 2 clear days not having to drive, not having to get somewhere, comfortable in the warm house with radio and TV, records and books, even with thoughts about the cold and murderous world and how we managed in it for a little while. Getting back to those paintings, 2 poems on the subject. Called Conversing with Paradise. Dedicated to Robert Jordan, a painter at our university, whose work I, and who himself I much admire. And conversing with paradise, the phrase is William Blake's, who speaks in a prose work about poetry, painting, and music, the three powers in man of conversing with paradise, which the flood did not sweep away. Conversing with Paradise, for Robert Jordan. To see the world the way a painter must, responsive to distances, alive to light, to changes in the colors of the day, his mind vibrating at every frequency he finds before him, from wind waves in wheat through trees that turn their leaves before the storm, to the string bag pattern of the pebbled waves over the shallows of the shelving cove in high sunlight, and to the greater wavelengths of boulder and building, to the vast majestic measures of the mountain's poise. And from these modulations of the light, to take the elected moment, silence it in oils and earths beneath the moving brush, and varnish it and put it in a frame to seal it off as privileged from time, and hang it for a window on the wall, a window giving on the ever-present past. How splendid it would be to be someone able to do these mortal miracles in silence and solitude without a word. I notice more and more I keep yakking in favor of silence. Well, these paradoxes are with us at all times. There's a somewhat nastier poem called The Museum, because of the connection with money adverted to before. It does make you feel kind of uneasy sometimes. Well, people have been saying, but that's not art, for as long as I've been around. Someday somebody's going to say, but that's not art, and they're all going to fall off the walls, and prices are going to go down terribly. Museum. The trees that mass-produce their leaves each spring offend the connoisseur, the sensitive handmaiden type who is in love with art. Here is the one-of-a-kindness of everything. Climate controlled against weathering time, bought with the money, warranted by wealth, gone on the public, but with reverence. Here must be where the gods go when they die. The naked ladies and the red-clad cardinals, the young man dead across the young girl's knees, landscapes receding as salvation does into a clear and vision-finishing blue. The plain geometries of the face of truth, perspective lines obedient vanishing at the vanishing point, and the beholder's eye beholden even at disappointment's end, where the sacred secret might have been profaned in a girl's smile or a patch of yellow wall, but wasn't. As the picture plane maintained a distant stillness, very God displayed like a banjo crosswise on his mother's knees. When we've been here for 3 hours and 15 minutes, you will let me know by creeping out slowly and silently, won't you? Good. This is not really a personal poem. It just pretends to be. Lord Bacon, even so proud a man, wrote to himself about his style, that it's like be as if you were sure of yourself and looking down from a great height. So I never write about little me, you know, nose-picking, nail-biting, and all the rest of it. I write about some very grand theoretical me, even when I'm pretending to write about me. who's called the author to his body on their 15th birthday. That's because it was the 29th of February in 1980. Amazing number of people who didn't get that and wrote into the magazine where it was published saying, he couldn't be 15, I've been reading him for 20 years. And I got a wonderful insight from a character in a novel by Stanley Elkin called The Insight Lady. She is nameless except it is Professor Naomi Lebowitz, my friend and neighbor. And she produced this wonderful... she's in Stanley's novel only for when things get a little slack. She rushes in, gives an insight, and rushes out again. It had nothing to do with the plot. And so Naomi gave me this insight on my 15th birthday. There's never a dull moment in the human body. Didn't I'll tell Naomi and she'll get you. All right, this is another sentence. Well, the reason this book was called Sentences may have better reasons, but... In a dream, some stranger came up and said, what are you calling your next book, before it was finished? And I said, Sentences. And it turned into my dog. The stranger turned into my dog and put his paws up and licked me. So I knew it was called Sentences. The author to his body on their 15th birthday. Dear old equivocal and closest friend, grand vizier to a weak, bewildered king, now we approach the Ecclesiastian age where the heart is like to go off inside your chest like a party favor, or the brain blow a fuse and the comic book light bulb of idea black out forever, the idiot balloon of speech go blank, and we shall know if it be knowing the world as it was before language once again. Mighty fortress, maybe already mined and readying to blow up grievances about the lifetime of your servitude, the body of this death one talkative saint wanted to be delivered of, not yet, aggressively asserting your ancient right to our humiliation by the bowel, or the rough justice of the elderly lechers retiring from this incontinence to that. Dark horse, it's you we've put the money on regardless, the parody and satire and the nevertheless forgiveness of the soul or mind, self, spirit, will, or whatever else the ever unknowable unknown is calling itself this time around. Shall we renew our vows? How should we know by now how we might do divorced? Homely animal, in sickness and health, for the duration. Buddy, you know the drill. How are we fixed for time, please? Somebody in the front.
9:34.
Oh, wow. Oh, I better fix it up to stop soon. Oh, I did want to read you a somewhat longer poem. It's 5 minutes long. Anybody who wants can creep out. This is happening. I know what it's... I can barely go to my own poetry readings, but thank you for coming. And this sums up some of the things that I've tried to be about. It's called The Painter Dreaming in the Scholar's House. And it's in memory of the painter Paul Klee, whose works I'm sure you know. I never knew him. He died when I was 20. And the American painter Paul Terence Feeley, who died when it was being written. It comes in four parts, which I will distinguish by pauses. The painter dreaming in the scholar's house. One. The painter's eye follows relation out. His work is not to paint the visible, he says, it is to render visible. Being a man and not a god, he stands already in a world of sense from which he borrows to begin with mental things chiefly, the abstract elements of language, the point, the line, the plane, the colors, and the geometric shapes. Of these, he spins relation out. He weaves its fabric up so that it speaks darkly as music does, singing the secret history of the mind. And when in this the visible world appears, as it does do, mountain, flower, cloud, and tree, all haunted here and there with the human face, it happens as by accident, although the accident is of design. It is because language first rises from the speechless world that the painterly intelligence can say correctly that he makes his world, not imitates the one before his eyes. Hence the delightsome gardens, the dark shores, the terrifying forests where nightfall enfolds a lost and tired traveler. And hence the careless crowd deludes itself by likening his hieroglyphic signs and secret alphabets to the drawing of a child. That likeness is significant the other side of what they see, for his simplicities are not the first ones, but the furthest ones, final refinements of his thought made visible. He is the painter of the human mind, finding and faithfully reflecting the mindfulness that is in things and not the things themselves. For such a man, art is an act of faith, prayer the study of it, as Blake says, and praise the practice. Nor does he divide making from teaching or from theory. The three are one, and in his hours of art there shines a happiness through darkest themes, as though spirit and sense were not at odds. 2. The painter, as an allegory of the mind at Genesis, he takes a burlap bag, tears it open, and tacks it on a stretcher. He paints it black because, as he has said, everything looks different on black. Suppose the burlap bag to be the universe, and black because its volume is the void before the stars were. At the painter's hand, volume becomes one-sidedly a surface, and all his depths are on the face of it. Against this flat abyss, this groundless ground of zero thickness stretched against the cold, dark silence of the absolutely not, material worlds arise, the colored earths and oil of plants that imitate the light. They imitate the light that is in thought, for the mind relates to thinking as the eye relates to light. Only because the world already is a language can the painter speak according to his grammar of the ground. It is archaic speech that has not yet divided out its cadences in words. It is a language for the oldest spells about how some thoughts rose into the mind while others, stranger still, sleep in the world. So grows the garden green, the sun vermilion. He sees the rose flame up and fade and fall and be the same rose still, the radiant in red. He paints his language, and his language is the theory of what the painter thinks. 3. The painter's eye attends to death and birth together, seeing a single energy momently manifest in every form, as in the tree, the growing of the tree exploding from the seed, not more nor less than from the void condensing down and in, summoning sun and rain. He views the tree, the great tree standing in the garden, say, as thrusting downward its vast spread and weight, growing its green height from dark-watered earth, and as suspended weightless in the sky, haled forth and held up by the hair of its head. He follows through the flowing of the forms from the divisions of the trunk out to the veinings of the leaf and the leaf's fall. His pencil meditates the many in the one after the method in the confluence of rivers, the running of ravines on mountainsides and in the deltas of the nerves. He sees how things must be continuous with themselves as withhold worlds that they themselves are not, in order that they may be so transformed. He stands where the eternity of thought opens upon perspective, time, and space. He watches mind become incarnate, then he paints the tree. 4. These thoughts have chiefly been about the painter Clay, about how he in our hard time might stand to us, especially whose lives concern themselves with learning, as patron of the practical intelligence of art, and thence as model, modest and humorous in sufferings, for all research that follows spirit where it goes. That there should be much goodness in the world, much kindness and intelligence, candor and charm, and that it all goes down in the dust after a while. This is a subject for the steadiest meditations of the heart and mind, as for the tears that clarify the eye toward charity. So may it be to all of us that at some times in this bad time when faith in study seems to fail, and when impatience in the street and still despair at home divide the mind to rule it, there shall some comfort come from the remembrance of so deep and clear a life as his, whom I have thought of for the wholeness of his mind, as the painter dreaming in the scholar's house, his dream an emblem to us of the life of thought, the same dream that then flared before intelligence when light first went forth looking for the eye. Thank you. Later tonight I'll tell Bach I outdone him. Won't that be terrible? He'll say, "What, son? What you say?" One poem to sum up some of these things. It took me about 40 years of trying to do this stuff before I remembered that we didn't make up the words. And I'm amazed. I explained to my students, "Oh, like Ring Lardner's, shut up," he explained. I asked my students, "Has it never struck you as remarkable as if Daddy had known it all along?" I'd just come across it, that whenever you wish to express your most original, deepest, and most intimate thoughts, all the words are there in the dictionary. So who were the guys who made up the possibility of poetry or anything else? I call them the makers. Machers? No. It's a translation of the Greek poetry, poem is something made. Hematopoiesis is blood making. All sorts of learned things like that. And in our language, the poets were still called the makers till the Renaissance, and William Dunbar's great poem, Lament for the Macaris, the Scotch form of it, where he says, all my friends, including Chaucer and Henryson, are dead, and I don't feel so good myself. Timor mortis conturbat me. Fear of death has got me. Well, the makers go way back beyond that. Who can remember back to the first poets, the greatest ones, greater even than Orpheus? No one has remembered that far back or now considers among the artifacts and bones and cantilevered inference the past is made of, those first and greatest poets, so lofty and disdainful of renown, they left us not a name to know them by. They were the ones that in whatever tongue worded the world, that were the first to say star, water, stone, that said the visible and made it bring invisibles to view in wind and time and change, and in the mind itself, that minded the hitherto idiot world, and spoke the speechless world, and sang the towers of the city into the astonished sky. They were the first great listeners attuned to interval, relationship, and scale, the first to say above, beneath, beyond, conjurers with love, death, sleep, with bread and wine, who having uttered, vanished from the world, leaving no memory but the marvelous magical elements, the breathing shapes and stops of breath we build our babbles of. Okay.